unheard of for me, but a little unusual. The second outline is the one we're going to be covering today. I will say in advance that I have a very firm policy of not mixing religion and politics. I don't get political in the pulpit. It's a very firm position that I take there. I'm going to take that position and put in the Cuisinart today. I'm not in such a way as to take a position for one candidate or one party or anything like that. But when we are considering the state of the nation, I think to a certain degree we're going to have to get a little bit political today. I want to talk about changes that I have seen in my life. And I'll say this. I am not a philosopher. I'm not a historian. I am not a political scientist by avocation or training. But I do have interest in all of those things. I have some degree of knowledge that I've attained, you know, through study and school and that sort of thing, enough to form what I would consider a relatively well-educated opinion that I'm going to share with you here today. And you can take it for what it's worth. It seems to me that our nation, from the very beginning, was founded by men who were guided by principle. People who believed in things. They didn't always believe in the same things, but those things tended to overlap very strongly. And they used those principles, those ideals, those foundations of philosophy. Oftentimes, by the way, which were not only grounded in the Bible, but rooted in the Bible. They used those principles to guide our country to become what it was. And you can go all the way back to 1776 and beyond. All the way back to the Pilgrims. William Bradford. All the way up to George Washington and Samuel Adams and Thomas Paine. And on through the next 150 years or so, Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, both Robert E. Lee and Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Calvin Coolidge, you know, on and on we could go. People who did not necessarily believe what everybody else believed, but they believed what they believed. And they were convinced that the best way to guide the country was to be led by their principles. And again, they didn't always agree with each other. But generally, they could be counted on to stand for what they believed. That changed in the 20th century. Particularly, I would suggest, in the 1950s. In the 1950s, we saw more and more, and I wasn't around for it, but from what I read, we see more and more in our history people who were no longer guided by their principles, but who were now guided by fear. People who were willing to put aside their principles and govern based on the immediate, based on what they were afraid of, what the people were afraid of, or what they thought the people were afraid of. Afraid of another Great Depression. Afraid of another World War. Afraid of nuclear Holocaust. Afraid of the communists. You know, later on, afraid of environmental disaster, and on and on. On into the 21st century, into, for instance, the 9/11 attacks, and the fear of terrorism, fear of drugs, on and we could go. We found that we were willing to temporarily put aside our principles because of our fear. That's the world that I grew up in. And I didn't realize what it was at the time, but now I feel that that's what I was watching. I believe, and again, you can take this for what it's worth, I believe that we are currently witnessing another change. That no longer are we going to see a nation that is guided by principle or even guided by fear. More and more I see, in my observations, a nation that is being guided by hate. And you think, well, is that much worse than fear? Yes, it's much worse than fear. And you know my position on fear. I have an entire series of lessons on fear and the importance of putting our fears aside in preference to the fear of God. I believe that. I believe fear can kill a Christian. I believe it does kill Christians. Hate's different. Fear is you convincing yourself that you can temporarily put your principles aside. You'll get back to your principles when the fear and the object of the fear is gone. But temporarily, you're going to be guided by the fear. Hate is a conscious decision to ignore your principles, to reject your principles. Hate is saying, I don't like you. I want you to pay. I want you to hurt. And it doesn't matter whether it furthers any good. It doesn't matter whether I actually get helped somehow. I will be helped because you are hurt. I see this over and over again in the media. I see it in the public discussion. And I see it among my brethren. I see it a lot. And it really, really concerns me. I fear greatly that we are on the way to seeing this as a normal way of interacting with one another. And such an attitude cannot possibly end any way other than with violence. With extreme and horrific violence. I hope that is not where we are going. I would love to be wrong on all of this. But I don't think that I am. And what I want to do for you to do here this evening with me is to look at ourselves. You're not going to be able to fix our culture. I'm not going to be able to fix our culture. If we made some kind of video of this sermon and went viral on YouTube and 100 million people watched it, it would not change our culture. I don't pretend to have that kind of power. What we can do is arm ourselves against this. And the first thing that we can do is to see it when it's happening. To recognize hate speech. And to reject it. To not fall victim to it. To not allow the vitriol, the hatred, the anger that's out there in the world. And that oftentimes is in our TV sets and in our newspapers and magazines. And certainly on the internet. To not allow that to affect us and make us drift further from the principles that God has based us on. We as Christians understand about principle, I hope, because our entire life is based on principle. We're doing the right thing as God defines the right thing. Not as George Washington defined it or as, you know, some philosopher of man or Aristotle or whatever. This is how God defined it. That's what we believe as Christians. We ought to be able to hold to our principles and reject fear and certainly reject hate. This is what I'm seeing nowadays. And I'm going to be fair here. I got a scale up here. I'm going to put stuff in both sides of the scale here. And just because we have to start somewhere, we'll start with the Republicans. At least I think we're starting with the Republicans. Whoops, wrong way. There we go. We're going to start with the Republicans. What do the Republicans hate? The Republicans hate Democrats. Right? That's what they hate. If the Democrats take a position, that's the wrong position. Just because they're Democrats. And beyond that, and more specifically, they hate the Clintons. Oh, boy, do they hate the Clintons. I mean, Miss Hillary's name comes up, Mr. Bill's name comes up. Oh, boy. You just can't get the Republicans to be quiet about that, right? They hate welfare. They hate people who abuse the system and take, and refuse to give. They hate abortion. Absolutely hate it. It's killing off our babies. That's a horrible, horrible thing. They hate terrorists. These are crazy people on the other side of the world who are, and not always on the other side of the world, by the way, who are trying to kill us, trying to bring us down. And while we're hating terrorists, we might as well hate all Muslims too. Because they're all the same thing. Maybe not every single Muslim is a terrorist, but they might as well be, right? That's what we're thinking anyway, what we're taught. And they hate the homosexuals. They hate the gays. Everybody knows that, right? This is a position that the Republicans take. And so we find somebody who is going to pander to this. Somebody who's going to find the hate and exploit it. And make us feel really good about our hate and fuel that hate. Now, on the other side, of course, the Democrats hate the GOP. They hate the Republicans. Can't do anything right if you're a Republican, right? And more specifically, they hate the Bushes. really, really hate the Bushes, right? Doesn't matter which one it is, although they have a special place in their heart for W, I suppose. They hate all the Bushes, though. They hate zealots, religious zealots, you know, people who take their religion really, really seriously and read the Bible in public and ask people to pray and have public prayers, for crying out loud. I mean, you can't have that kind of thing. They hate big corporations because big corporations are bringing us down and subverting government and all that kind of thing, trying to withhold medicine from us and kill our senior citizens and all that kind of stuff. They hate guns like you wouldn't believe, because guns, of course, kill people left and right without even a human being to fire them. The guns are going to fire. They hate polluters, people who are going to take an axe to our planet and destroy the very planet that we live on. Absolutely hate all of that. And the 1%, the people up at the top end of the food chain, hate these people. Absolutely hate. And if you get somebody up on the stump who will preach this gospel to people who are ready for the red meat, they want to eat it up. They want it. They get motivated. They get pumped up. And the thing is, the people who preach this message, by and large, let me rephrase that. And this is a bit of the politics coming in here. Forgive me reaching out here a little bit. I'm firmly convinced that the people who appear to be at the head of the ticket of both of these parties don't care any about this stuff. They're not believers. They're hate mongers, is what they are. And the easiest way to find an audience, the easiest way to motivate an audience, the easiest way to get funds raised, get commercials on the TV, and ultimately get your people in office, is to fuel this, to get people worked up into this absolute lather where they're so hateful, so angry at somebody that they're either going to vote the right way or shoot somebody, one or the other. And frankly, as long as they shoot the right person, it doesn't much matter one way or the other. This is the problem that we have created. I don't want you to go away from this saying that I'm blaming Donald Trump or I'm blaming Hillary Clinton or any other individual. Like, I am not. I'm blaming me. I'm blaming you. I'm blaming the voters. I'm blaming every American who created this atmosphere, who gave in to hate, who decided that this was a legitimate way of making a decision. This was a legitimate way of running a country. This is what we have wrought. This is our fault. It's not any particular political party or particular politician's fault. It's our fault. We did this to ourselves. What we can do as Christians, and what we must do as Christians, is to not allow this rhetoric to affect us. To reject hate. To reject what the common people will call hate speech, but I want to be more specific than that, and more broaden that as well. Hate speech does not just mean I don't like a particular ethnic group. I wish they would all die. That's hate speech. But it gets a lot worse than that, and it gets a lot more broad than that. Do you understand that the more hateful we get, the less like Jesus we get? There is ample Bible to demonstrate this, and we're going to turn to some passages here to demonstrate this. We read one of them already in Colossians chapter 3. Now, I'll isolate verse number 8 here, where he says there, Paul says, "But now you also put them all aside, anger, wrath, malice, slander, and abusive speech from your mouth." The reason that we put these things away is because they no longer characterize us. We are the people of God. We are setting our mind on Jesus, on the things above, like Paul said earlier in the text. And if that is the case, if we are holy beings, if we are righteous beings, if we are motivated by the love that God has shown to us in the giving of His Son Jesus, if we are motivated to serve Him and honor Him, then this kind of atmosphere is corrosive to us, and we know that. What were the first two commandments that Jesus said that apply to us? Love. And then love. That's who we are. That's who we must be. And when we allow this kind of rhetoric to change us, we necessarily become less like Jesus. And so I want to make sure that we identify it in ourselves. And I'm talking about our jokes. I'm talking about our Facebook posts. I'm talking about everything that we do. Examine ourselves very carefully, as I've been doing recently, and not necessarily always liking what I see. God's wisdom is exactly the opposite of the kind of speech that we see
in our political scene today, and not just in the political scene. In James chapter 3, verse number 17 and 18, James tells us here, the wisdom that is above, and he's been talking about the wisdom from below, the wisdom that's evil and demonic, he says. The wisdom which is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy. And the seed whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. You get frustrated that it looks like the people in the political world these days not only can't get along, they are determined not to get along. They have no interest in getting along. It's not a matter of finding common ground. They don't want common ground. They want a war zone. Because if they're not fighting, if they're not hating, then nobody knows where they stand. They got to be against something. Always got to be against something. Well, that's politics. Okay, we can have a political theory, class somewhere else. But as far as God's people pursuing the things of God, we understand that that is exactly the opposite of what we are to do. God's wisdom is first pure. Make sure that you're doing the right thing, first of all. And knowing that you're doing the right thing, how do you pursue that right thing? In peace, he says, peaceable, gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy. How many politicians immediately jump to mind when you read that verse? Of either stripe, of any stripe. What difference does it make? We have to be different. We have to put God first. We have to reject hate in every sense. The phrase that's oftentimes used here is, hate the sin, love the sinner. I believe that. I think that it's not only good to hate sin, I think it's necessary to hate sin. I think part of the big problem in our culture is we don't hate sin enough. There is a far cry from that, a far difference, a much great difference between hating the sin and hating the sinner, though. We are told that we must love the sinner. And that doesn't mean that we tell him how much we really mean this for his own good as we beat him about the head with a baseball bat. You can call anything you want to call love. I have been abused mightily by people who claim they did it out of love. Maybe you have too. I'm not talking about spankings when you're kids. That's not what I mean. I mean people who will do intentional harm, long-term harm, to somebody. And if you think Christians don't do that, you haven't been paying attention. Or else you are greatly blessed, far more than I am, as far as that kind of thing goes. Name-calling is not love. We have all kinds of names that we use for people who sin. Let's not mince words about this. It's sin. You talk about homosexuals, talk about lazy people, you talk about drunks. We go on and on. Fornicators, whatever. It's sin. And there's no two ways about that. That being said, Ephesians 4 verse 29 tells us, let no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth, but only such a word as is good for edification according to the need of the moment, so that it will give grace to those who hear. Grace. Give grace. Make them better off. I have yet to have anybody even attempt to explain to me why it is a loving thing to call somebody by a racist name or an otherwise bigoted name. My brethren in my lifetime have done a fairly good job, I think, of leaving behind most of the racist rhetoric. Some of the people who grew up on it are having difficulty letting go. That's between them and God. I'm not getting into that. But there are a considerable number of people in my generation and in subsequent generations who think it's perfectly adequate and appropriate to use all kinds of hateful rhetoric, and that's the only way to describe it, hateful rhetoric, toward people who are in one measure of sin or another, especially homosexuals. And ridiculing them is okay, mocking them is okay, calling them names is okay, because basically we're shaming sinners. Well, I have no problem with calling sin, sin. But that kind of rhetoric does not fit in with this context. That's not what Paul tells us we're supposed to do. In no way does that bring grace to the hearer. In no way does that reflect the image of Jesus Christ. Misrepresentation is not love. How many times have we heard that? And I hear this from the pulpit a lot, by the way. The internet is a feeding ground for misrepresentation. And the preacher has a particular point that he wants to make. And so he finds some kind of weird blog somewhere that gives him a good illustration. He's going to grab it. And he'll use it. I'll give you an example of this. There is a story that goes around, and I haven't seen it in a while, about eagles, about how eagles get up to a certain age in their life, and their talons are dull, and their beak is dull, and they can't hunt like they could, and eagles get to be relatively old. This is maybe 20 or 25 years, and they're going to starve. And so what the eagle does is he finds some big crag in the rock, and he just beats himself bloody trying to sharpen his beak and his claws. And he will like literally bang his head against this rock, trying to sharpen his beak, trying to sharpen his claws. And because he does that, because he's willing to take one, looking at the long term, he's able to live another 10, 15 years. It's a great story. It makes for all kinds of brilliant illustrations regarding old age and giving up and sacrifice and that sort of thing. Trouble is, it's just not true. Okay, it does not happen. Eagles don't do that. It's completely and totally fiction. And you go and point that out to a preacher who says, well, it's a good story though. Well, yeah, it's a good story. It's a lie, but it's a good story. And then the next month he preaches that sermon somewhere else. How do we do that? And that's misrepresenting an eagle. I'm not sure exactly anybody's going to go to heaven or hell based on misrepresenting an eagle's reputation. That being said, we have people misrepresenting human beings all the time. Partly because the initial story that they heard fits the argument that they're trying to make. Partly because they're lazy and they don't want to find the truth. Partly just because they don't love their brethren like they ought to. And so therefore they will accept misrepresentation and not find the truth, not care to find the truth. Colossians chapter 3, again, verse 9. Do not lie to one another, since you lay aside the old self with its evil practices. You ever been lied to by a politician? Think hard. I bet you can come up with something, right? Were you terribly surprised? Maybe the first time you were. Maybe if it was somebody that you really respected. But you got over that eventually, right? Because you realize, you know, this is just kind of what happens. We're not happy about it. We're not satisfied with it. We're not accepting the status quo. But we're realizing this is the world we live in, though. Christians are different. Or Christians certainly ought to be different. How dare we not be different? Can we honestly adopt the tactics of Satan like this? Simply because it gets the job done. Because it points out the enemy, because it exposes them for what they are, because it advances some kind of noble cause that we may have or whatever. We have absolutely no business doing that kind of thing. It's hateful. Assuming the worst is not love. We're supposed to believe all things, right? 1 Corinthians 13, verse 7, that's part of the description of love that he gives in that context. Hopes all things, believes all things. If you believe all, and we're not talking about being naive here. We're talking about having confidence that a brother in Christ who acknowledges Jesus Christ as the Savior, who as far as you know is serving Jesus Christ, you have no reason to expect otherwise. When you get the impression that perhaps he is caught up in some kind of sin, that he is in fact serving the devil instead of serving Jesus, your first reaction is, there must be some other explanation for that. I know him. He's not like that. He's a Christian. Christians don't do that. Well, we all know, of course, Christians do that. Far too often. But we as Christians owe it to one another to have confidence in one another. How can we possibly build a society of believers when we don't trust each other? We see what's happening in the world around us. When you have one group and this other group and they don't like each other and they're fighting and then people are choosing up sides and it's all kinds of bickering and fighting and bloodshed. We don't want that in the church. Why should we have that in the church? But we do have that in the church. And the reason we have it in the church is the same reason that we have it in the world.
because people don't love each other like they should. Because they embrace hate instead of embracing God's principles of love. So let's talk about who we're not supposed to hate. And we'll start with the enemies because they're obvious. Do not hate your enemy. This is what God has taught you. Now, somebody may at some point bring in Malachi chapter 1 verse 3. God hated Esau. Well, hate can't be an entirely bad thing because God hated, and so therefore maybe it's appropriate for us to hate. Well, let me emphasize this first of all. You're not God. Okay? If God wants to hate, that's his business. I assure you that if God told you not to hate, and you were to raise your hand in judgment and say, yes, God, I know what the Bible says, but I read over in Malachi that you hate, and I'm trying to be like God, so I just hated too. And God says, well, I never thought about it that way, Hal. You're a pretty smart guy. Go ahead and go in there. No, I don't think so. I think it might be a better idea for us to simply do exactly what Jesus Christ told us to do, and that is love your enemies. And I really don't think this is that complicated. I don't think that we have to scratch our heads and come up with committees and all kinds of documents and whatnot, have a select committee put together some theories for voting or whatever, how we go about loving our enemies. This is not difficult. How would you like to be treated? You'd like to be treated with fairness, with equity, maybe a little bit of mercy, some patience. Have people appreciate you for your values, not just judge you on your mistakes. Certainly not judge you by other people. Well, do that for other people. It's not rocket science. We can do this. We can do what Jesus has commanded us to do. Love your enemies. Pray for them. There's a good one. Pray for them. Pray for the conversion of the Muslim world. Pray for the salvation of souls in Iran, North Korea, Saudi Arabia, all these places. You can do that. Rather than, well, you know, if we can finally get a president brave enough to push the button and just turn that entire part of the country into a parking lot, then we can send all of our, you know, the Halliburton people over there and start pumping out the oil and keeping it for ourselves, and we'll just turn this whole thing around. Well, you know what? Maybe we would. I don't know. But I'll assure you of this. That would not be the godly thing to do. That is exactly the opposite of what God has told us over and over again. And I'll try to be practical about this, because if I sent you home saying, what Hal told you to do is not hate your enemies. Okay, I can do that. Not hate your enemies. Good point, Hal. Good job. Thank you very much. And if we didn't do it any more practical than that, I think maybe the point would be lost. So let me give you a couple of handles to grab onto. Quit denying them basic human dignity. Okay, I'm not saying you have to invite them over for dinner and pork chops. I'm saying that if we are made in the image of God, if all of us are made in the image of God, that means there is a spark of the divine in every single one of us. There is something about our enemy that looks like God. There is something about him that is made in his image. And that, if nothing else, that deserves our respect. So if they are human beings, they need to be treated like human beings. And that refers to our tone of voice, that refers to the presuppositions that we make or do not make. Quit driving them away from Jesus. Colossians again, chapter 4, verses 4 through 6. Or 5 and 6. Conduct yourselves with wisdom toward outsiders, making the most of your opportunity. Let your speech always be with grace, as though seasoned with salt, so that you will know how you should respond to each person. I have around 1,000, a little more than 1,000 Facebook friends these days. And those friends have other friends. I'm sure if you were to put together 3 or 4 steps of separation, you could cover all of the United States and a great deal beyond the United States. I'm told that every single human being can connect to every other human being on the planet with 7 degrees of separation. That's a remarkable kind of thing. That's the world that we live in today. It is not unreasonable at all to assume that this snarky thing that I say about an individual, about an ethnic group, about a religion, whatever, that I put on Facebook without a whole lot of thought, 5 seconds thought, blah, 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 boom. And within 10 minutes, 20 minutes or whatever, I've got, you know, 10 likes and 4 or 5 positive comments and maybe a couple of shares or whatever. And oh, aren't I clever? It's not beyond the scope at all to think that a person that I was talking to, a person that I was ridiculing, is going to see that post. And the question is that person going to draw closer to Jesus because of what I did or be pushed further away? And if they're going to be pushed further away, then why did I do that? What purpose did I accomplish with that? I fed red meat to the haters. That's all I did. And everybody likes me. Everybody appreciates me. Values what I have to say. And that makes me feel good about myself. But I'm supposed to be saving souls. I'm supposed to be representing Jesus Christ. And if somebody is less likely to listen to Jesus because I stand for Jesus, then there's something fundamentally wrong. I need to back up and retrench and reevaluate everything that I say in public. And by the way, if I'm reevaluating what I say in public, I might as well reevaluate what I say in private. Because have you ever said something that you thought was in private that turned out to be not quite so private? We've all done it, right? Why not just simplify things, and instead of being haters in private, instead of being haters in the family, where everybody's going to keep each other's secrets, why don't we just not be haters at all? Why don't we just always do things the way Jesus wants us to do them, instead of when we think we're going to have to be responsible? Do not hate your neighbor. Love your neighbor, right? That's what Jesus said. The most repeated statement in the Old Testament is Leviticus 19, verse 17. Love your neighbor as yourself. I am aware that there's a lot of bad stuff out there in the world. I'm aware that my neighbors are rascals, a lot of them. And I'm not just talking about the people over in Autumn Pine Circle. I'm talking about humans on this planet. I'm talking about Americans. I'm talking about Floridians, Southerners, whatever. Human beings are a problem. For the time being, we're going to have to deal with that. Because, you know, unless you're going to go up to the one-man Mars colony or live on the space station or something like that, you're going to have to deal with human beings. And the fact is, a lot of human beings are objectionable to one degree or another. I don't have any problem with accepting generalities as generalities. The Apostle Paul puts his stamp of approval on that kind of thought in Titus chapter 1. And verse number 12, he says, one of themselves, that is these people there in Crete where Titus is, one of themselves, a prophet of their own, said, Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons. And as he says there in verse 13, this testimony is true. I've fought with that for years and years and years. I finally decided that Paul means exactly what it sounds like he says. There's a lot of rotten people in Crete. You know this. They know this. They brag about it. We can generalize about Americans, we can generalize about Muslims, we can generalize about Europeans or whatever. But let's realize what Titus realized, what Paul realized, that the generalities that we are talking about cannot cloud the judgment that we make of individuals and of individual situations. We must do what Jesus said in John 7, verse 24, do not judge according to appearances, but judge righteous judgment. Well, he came from Crete, therefore he must be a liar and a lazy glutton and all the rest. No, that's not what Paul said. And that's not what we're supposed to say. If you want to take extra caution, if someone has connections to terrorism or has, they speak positively of terrorism or something like that, I'm not saying you have to wait until you watch his shoes, light on fire before you start calling the FBI. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying we are responsible. We judge fairly, we judge individually. We do not broadly assume based on generalities. We love our neighbors as ourselves, as Jesus says there in Matthew 22 and verse number 29. What does that mean? Well, as we mentioned already, quit acting prejudicially based on affiliations. The enemy of my friend is my enemy, or the friend of my friend is my enemy, whatever it is. You know, if someone is associated with the wrong person, that makes them the wrong person. No, it does not. That is a shortcut. That is laziness. It is us not wanting to put in the time to get to know people. If I can just say, oh, he came from Saudi Arabia, that means X. Okay, now I don't have to work. I don't have to get to know him. I don't have to do anything. I can just go ahead and put him in a category and move on. We owe our fellow human beings better than that. We owe our neighbors better than that. I realize it's more work. I realize it puts more responsibility on us. And I realize that a lot of our neighbors and a lot of our brethren are doing a lot easier than that. But our responsibility is to do what Jesus has told us to do. Quit reacting out of anger. Quit getting so caught up in the moment that we... And you knew we were going to talk about traffic eventually, right? Love your neighbor while you're driving. That's tough sometimes, right? If you want to toot your horn every once in a while to tell the fellow parked at the green light that, hey, you know what? It's a green light. We're allowed to go in Santa Rosa County now. It's green light means go. That's okay. I don't have any issue with that. I may share with you in that. Laying on your horn every time somebody cuts you off in the parking lot or at an intersection or runs a yellow light or something like that, we need to stop that. We just need to let this go. This is not helping things. I cannot remember the time that I did something specifically because I was angry that ordinarily I would not have done that turned out to be a good thing. I've done it a lot. I don't get angry all that often, but when I do, you know, sometimes I do things and I regret them, right? You know what I'm talking about. You do the same thing. Well, let's just not do that. Let's control our anger. Let's control our rage. Let's quit ignoring the golden rule. You know what the golden rule is, right? Matthew 7:12, some of you can probably quote it. As you would mention, do unto you, do even so to them. For this is the law and the prophets, Jesus said. We all know that. We all accept that. And we all reject that when it comes time to actually put it into practice. Yes, I should do what I want people to do to me, except for this guy who's just really on my nerves. Or this person here who's friends with somebody I don't like, or whatever it happens to be. Treat people the way you want to be treated. You'll be amazed at how many of these problems were overcome with such a simple application of such a profound philosophy from our Lord. This may be a little bit more challenging, for me anyway. Do not hate your government. Government is a blessing that's given to us. I'm aware that it does not always act like a blessing, that sometimes that acts like a curse. I get that. I'm also aware that virtually every other government in the history of this planet has been much, much, much worse than ours. So maybe we ought to be counting our blessings. I'm also aware that God spent a great deal of time criticizing government through his prophets, Old and New Testament. Old Testament, the prophets would go to the kings, lash out against them. In the New Testament, prophets, apostles would go to the religious establishment, the people, the leaders of the people, lash out against them. It's worth noting, by the way, though, that these ones were doing their work by inspiration. They're being led by God. You and I are not. That's a significant difference between those two things. It's also worth noting that the governments that we're talking about in the Bible that received the wrath of the prophets and apostles, generally speaking, were the people of God. That's a pattern for our leaders who let us down. The pattern in the New Testament for our political leaders who let us down is quite easy to understand. It really is not complicated at all. Let me give you an example. In 2 Peter chapter 2, and verse number, 1 Peter chapter 2, verse number 13. Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, and by the way, that includes the Roman government, being led by a dictator who oftentimes hated Christians and from time to time was known to put them to death. Okay? That in mind. Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as one in authority or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right, for such is the will of God that by doing right you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. Act as free men and do not use your freedom as a covering for evil, but use it as bond slaves of God. Honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. Do you realize that Peter is writing this sometime in the early part of the sixth decade in AD? And in a handful of years after the writing of this letter. Peter himself is going to be executed by officials of the Roman government. He's going to be killed without a decent cause because he stood for what was right. And after that, others are going to be killed. Paul's going to be killed. Virtually all of the apostles are going to be killed. No doubt people who are reading this letter in the first century read it in the context of Peter's death, read it in the context of their own potential death. It did not become less inspired when that happened. It did not become less authoritative when that happened. Submit to government. Honor the king. Unless the king is trying to kill you. No, actually it doesn't say that, does it? Honor the king. I struggle with this. I'll be perfectly frank with you. Because lots of times I don't like the king. Or whatever government official you might want to talk about. He's against my principles. Intentionally so. Trying to subvert my lifestyle. Trying to drag me down. Trying to take my money. Whatever. And so therefore I feel it not only appropriate and approved, but to a certain degree laudable, that I lash out against the government, that I hate the government, or at least certain parts of it, more and more parts all the time. The Bible says we're supposed to not do that. I am not supposed to do that. I love telling jokes. I mean, I really, really do. I love telling jokes. I love making people laugh. And more and more, I find myself backing up. So, you know what? Maybe that's not a joke. Maybe that is not something I ought to be talking about. Maybe that is not respectful. As a Christian, ought to be respectful. Judge for yourself where you draw the line. But wherever it is, draw it in such a way that you can say, I did what Peter told me to do. I am honoring the king. That means, practically speaking, keep criticism civil and respectful. And by all means, keep it civil and respectful on Facebook. Please, I'm begging you. Because it just gets horrible. And not just that, of course. You see these videos of political rallies? You got the one side over here, and they got their signs, and this side over here, and they got their signs. And everybody's yelling and screaming and threatening, and nobody's really listening to anybody else. Nothing is being accomplished. Everybody knows nothing's being accomplished. So why are we doing this? Why am I watching this? What purpose does any of this serve other than to make us less like Jesus? Us as individuals, us as a society. Yes, we're going to disagree. When we disagree, keep it civil. Keep it respectful. Quit demanding justice as a prerequisite. Justice is one of those very, very popular words these days. When the government gives me justice, then I'm going to respect government. Well, you're respecting government because government does what you tell it to do, which is nice. But that's not what Jesus says. Jesus doesn't say respect government because it behaves itself. Jesus says respect government because it's from God. And so therefore we owe it to government regardless of what form that government takes, regardless of what individual is in that government, or how disreputable he may be, how disrespectful he himself may be. His bad attitude cannot become my bad attitude. Hate is a contagious disease, but you have an inoculation that you can take that will ward it off if applied properly. Jesus Christ. You can and you must keep this out of your system. Disobey government only in matters of faith. I find it remarkable that most of the people who are encouraging civil disobedience wind up not paying their taxes. How many, maybe Hardy shouldn't be listening to this, how many of you really enjoy paying your taxes? April 15th, that's your day, right? You really get into that. No. No, we don't like that. And so we're going to show disrespect to government by doing what we want to do. Well, isn't that convenient? Isn't that nice?
maybe it's not so much that we have a philosophical problem with our government. Maybe it's just that we want to do what we want to do. And in this particular situation, we would rather serve our own personal selfish needs, short-term needs, than do what Jesus has told us to do. It may be just exactly that simple. Hate is from the devil. Hate cannot accomplish God's ends. What we have to do is submit to government. And yes, occasionally rebel when we have to. When submitting to government means not submitting to God. But the rule, thankfully, in our country is not that way. Generally speaking, you can do both. Romans chapter 13, verse 2. Therefore, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. That's not complicated. You can understand that. You don't need me to explain that to you. We have to obey the government. Well, what if the government takes away my rights? Well, then we'll miss our rights. I'm quite sure. I'll miss mine. What if the government takes my money? Well, we'll certainly miss our money. But you know what? Maybe by having a stark choice between us, we can firm up in our minds and in the minds of those who are watching us, who really is our Lord. Are we willing to serve Jesus even when it really, really hurts? Even when it means that we have to reject the philosophy of the world, not join in with the joking, not join in with the yelling, not join in with the rhetoric, and simply be the child of God that Jesus wants us to be. That's a lot to chew on. It's a lot for me to chew on, and I'm not done chewing yet. But I encourage you to take this home and think about this. And accept, at least in principle, the overall point that we're making here. That is that hate is the enemy of the cause of Christ. Hate is the enemy of Jesus, of the people of Jesus. And that hate is tearing apart this country. Again, you and I probably can't stop that. But what we can do is keep it from attaching itself to us. Keep it from tearing apart the church of Jesus Christ. Because God's cause is all about love, not about hate. And we'll close there. Thank you for listening. Pray with me on this. Study on this. Allow Jesus to govern every aspect of your life, including your political discussion. If you're not a child of God, and if you need to become one, if you need to be bought by the blood of Christ and ushered into the kingdom of Jesus Christ through baptism, if you need to confess fault in some fashion, in some public fashion, for some kind of public wrong, if you need the encouragement and the support of brothers and sisters in Christ who love you and are supporting you, we want to be of assistance to you in any way that we possibly can. If we can do any of that this evening, please respond to the invitation while we stand and sing at this time.